KPFT. This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are rescuing these people, pulling out the living, the torn apart, and the martyrs. That's what we're doing.
Oil strikes central Beirut, Yemen, and Gaza after a massive attack Friday on a Beirut suburb that killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, one of the most powerful figures in the region.
And to the Ayatollah's regime, I say those who strike us, we will strike them. There is no place in Iran or the Middle East that the long arm of Israel cannot reach.
We'll go to Beirut and Tel Aviv for the latest. We'll also look at Iran's response with Iranian-American Trita Parsi, vice president of the Quincy Institute. His new piece, Nasrallah Assassinated. What happens next? Then Hurricane Helene tears through the southeastern United States after hitting Florida as a Category 4 storm. As scientists say, climate change rapidly intensifies hurricanes, and Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump downplays the danger.
Alabama and all of the other states who have been really hit hard by that very large hurricane. That was that big one, a very large hurricane this week. We're with you all the way, and if we were there, we'd be helping you, and you'll be okay.
We'll speak with climate scientist Peter Kalmus in Raleigh, North Carolina. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's marking 3 days of mourning after Israel assassinates Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah Friday in a massive attack that leveled multiple high-rise apartment buildings in a suburb south of Beirut. Nasrallah had led Hezbollah since 1992, was widely considered one of the most powerful figures in the Middle East. Multiple news outlets report Israel likely used U.S.-made 2,000-pound Blue 109 bombs in the attack. President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris both described Nasrallah's death as a, quote, measure of justice. But on the streets of Beirut, Lebanese residents vowed to keep resisting the Israeli attacks.
You won't be able to destroy us, whatever you do, however much you bomb, however much you displace people. We will stay here. We won't leave. This is our country, and we're staying. Do whatever you want to do. We don't care.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave the order to kill Nasrallah shortly after giving a speech at the United Nations General Assembly here in New York. As he was being introduced at the UN, dozens of diplomats walked out of the General Assembly hall in protest. Iran responded to the assassination of Nasrallah by seeking an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, warning Israel is, quote, pushing the entire region into an all-out catastrophe, unquote. A prominent general in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard was also killed in Friday's attack on Nasrallah. Over the past 24 hours, Israeli strikes in Lebanon killed at least 105 people, bringing the death toll over the past 2 weeks to more than 1,000 Lebanese, with 6,000 people injured. The Israeli attacks have also displaced about 1 million people in Lebanon. More than 100,000 have fled from Lebanon to Syria. Earlier today, Israel killed the head of Hamas in Lebanon, along with his wife, son and daughter, in a strike on their home in a Palestinian refugee camp. A separate strike inside Beirut Israel killed three members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Fears are now growing Israel may soon launch a ground invasion of Lebanon. Earlier today, Hezbollah's deputy leader, Sheikh Naim Qassem, vowed the group is ready to confront an Israeli invasion. In Gaza, Israel is continuing to attack schools where displaced Palestinians have sought shelter. Earlier today, an Israeli warplane bombed a school in Beit Lahia, killing at least two people. In Deir al-Balah, another Israeli strike killed Palestinian journalist Wafa al-Udaini and three of her family members, including two children. On Sunday, at least four people were killed in northern Gaza in another Israeli strike on a school-turned-shelter. Israel also launched a large attack on Yemen's port of Hodeidah on Sunday, one day after the Houthis fired a missile at Tel Aviv. The Yemeni health ministry said at least four people were killed and 29 injured in the Israeli attack. An unprecedented tragedy. Those were the words of North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper after Hurricane Helene devastated a swath of the country from Florida to Tennessee. The storm's death toll is nearing 100 and expected to rise as search and rescue teams reach areas cut off by catastrophic flooding and landslides. Millions have lost power in what's expected to become one of the costliest hurricanes in U.S. history. At least 30 deaths occurred in Buncombe County, North Carolina, where the city of Asheville has been largely cut off after the Swannanoa River crested 6 feet above previous records, flooding entire neighborhoods. Asheville officials said residents may not have access to clean water for weeks after the storm severely damaged the city's water treatment plant and piping system. Food and water are now being airlifted into Asheville, since many roads leading in the area have been destroyed. Hurricane Helene made landfall on Friday in Florida's Big Bend as a 140-mile-per-hour Category 4 hurricane that had been fueled by abnormally warm water in the Gulf of Mexico. On Saturday, Greenpeace posted a message on social media reading, quote, "Hurricane Helene must be a wake-up call for climate justice." In Nepal, nonstop monsoon rains and floods over the weekend killed nearly 200 people as rescue teams continue to search through the wreckage in the capital, Kathmandu. People were left marooned on rooftops as streets turned into rivers and major roadways became blocked. It was Kathmandu's heaviest rainfall in half a century as the climate crisis intensifies extreme weather events. Spanish authorities say 48 people are missing after a boat carrying refugees from Mali, Mauritania and Senegal capsized near the Canary Islands. 9 deaths, including a child, have been confirmed. Another 27 people have been rescued. The disaster could become the deadliest in the Canary Islands in 30 years. A Spanish nonprofit reports an average of 33 deaths per day for refugees trying to reach Spain in the first 5 months of this year, as many European governments continue to crack down on asylum seekers and promote xenophobic rhetoric. In Austria, the far-right Freedom Party won this weekend's parliamentary election, edging out the ruling conservatives and sending shockwaves throughout Europe. But it's unclear if the Freedom Party will be able to form a governing coalition, as all of its rivals have ruled out collaboration. Party leader Herbert Kickl ran on a nationalist platform pledging to restrict asylum and migration and expel non-EU citizens. The Freedom Party was founded in the wake of World War II by former Nazis. On Sunday, protesters gathered outside the Parliament building in Vienna chanting, "Nazis, get out of Parliament."
That means social cuts for Austria. That means lower salaries. That means a catastrophe, especially for migrants and for the women who are demonstrating in favor of abortion again. We started demonstrating 40 years ago, and I can't do it anymore.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of waging war on hospitals after Russia struck a hospital in the city of Sumy, killing 10 people. Meanwhile, Ukraine launched one of its largest drone strikes on Russia Saturday night. Russian military authorities report they shot down 125 drones during the attack. Authorities in Egypt are refusing to release Ali Abdel Fattah, the country's most prominent political prisoner. He was due to be released on Sunday after serving a 5-year sentence, but his sentence has been extended by another 2 years. Last week, a coalition of 59 civil society organizations called for Egypt to release the British-Egyptian activist. His mother, Leila Swaif, spoke to Reuters last week.
I'm definitely angry, really angry from the way things are happening, and of course angry about him continuing to be imprisoned. He wasn't supposed to be in jail for 5 years, let alone the 5 years before in his first jail term. I'm angry about what happened now and what is happening, but I don't have the feeling that I was expecting something to happen, and it did not happen. I never expect good things.
To see our interviews with Ala's mother and sister in Egypt, go to democracynow.org. Vice President Kamala Harris visited the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona Friday and pushed for new restrictions on asylum seekers.
Those who cross our borders unlawfully will be apprehended and removed and barred from reentering for 5 years. We will pursue more severe criminal charges against repeat violators. And if someone does not make an asylum request at a legal point of entry and instead crosses our border unlawfully, they will be barred from receiving asylum.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is escalating his anti-immigrant rhetoric, describing immigrants as animals during a campaign rally in Wisconsin.
They don't commit crimes like us. No, no. They make our criminals look like babies. These are stone-cold killers. They'll walk into your kitchen, they'll cut your throat.
During the same speech, he claimed Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were both mentally impaired. Meanwhile, Senator J.D. Vance and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz are preparing for Tuesday's vice presidential debate here in New York. In other election news, the Department of Justice has sued the state of Alabama after it purged more than 3,000 names from its voter rolls. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom is facing backlash from artists, lawmakers, labor groups, and others after he vetoed a bill Sunday that sought to regulate the artificial intelligence industry. The bill would have required tech companies to stress test AI models before releasing them on the market, held companies legally liable for harms caused by their AI technology, and enabled a kill switch for AI technology that was abused or went rogue. Backers of the bill accused Governor Newsom of being in the pocket of Silicon Valley. In Georgia, a fire at the BioLab chemical plant in Conyers sent massive plumes of thick smoke into the air Sunday, prompting the evacuation of some 17,000 residents and shelter-in-place orders for others. It's BioLab's third fire in 7 years. Conyers has a majority Black population. And in the UK, climate activists from Just Stop Oil threw cans of tomato soup at two Vincent van Gogh paintings, including sunflowers, at London's National Gallery on Friday. The action came just hours after a London judge sentenced two other activists to prison for throwing soup at the same painting and gluing themselves to the walls of the National Gallery 2 years ago. The judge said his harsh sentences of up to 2 years in prison for Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland, both in their early 20s, was meant to deter protesters from such acts of civil disobedience. It's the latest in a string of criminal prosecutions against activists in the UK. ahead of Friday's sentence, over 100 artists and art workers signed an open letter asking for leniency for Plummer and Holland. Protesters also rallied outside the London court to show support for the two activists who've been described as political prisoners.
Recently in this country, peaceful, non-violent people who protested weren't locked up. That was really rare. And in the last few years, and particularly in the last sort of 2 months, basically, almost 50 people have been locked up for daring to non-violently, you know, resist the oil industry, resist the genocide in Gaza. And that's just not acceptable in a democracy.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. News reports from northern Israel show Israeli military tanks massing along the Israel-Lebanon border after Israel launched its first attack in central Beirut. Earlier today, Israel struck a building near the busy Kola Bridge intersection of the Lebanese capital after carrying out a massive attack Friday on a Beirut suburb that assassinated Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. He led Hezbollah for more than 3 decades and was considered one of the most powerful figures in the Middle East. Israel likely used U.S.-made bombs in Friday's attack that leveled several high-rise apartment buildings. President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris both called the killing of Nasrallah a, quote, measure of justice. Meanwhile, Monday's attack targeted senior figures in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian militant group. The strike leveled another apartment building.
We are Palestinian firefighters and rescuers from the camps in Lebanon who came to help our brothers after the raid that happened here in Ain Ed Delb. We have been here since yesterday, since the incident. We have not left the site, and we will remain here until we complete the entire mission, God willing. There are still people under the rubble, people we have not been able to rescue yet. We are doing everything we can to save them as quickly as possible.
So today, Israel killed the head of Hamas in Lebanon, along with his wife, son and daughter, in a strike on their home in a Palestinian refugee camp. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave the order to kill Nasrallah shortly after giving a speech before the UN General Assembly. Before his remarks, dozens of diplomats walked out of the UN General Assembly hall in protest. Today, Hezbollah's deputy leader, Sheikh Naim Qassem, vowed to fight on, saying the group is prepared for a long war in his first speech since Nasrallah was killed.
Israel is committing massacres in all areas of Lebanon and choosing villages one by one until there is no village or house that does not have traces of Israeli aggression in it. It is attacking civilians, health organizations, al-Rizaleh scouts, all those who are in the streets and all those who are staying in their homes, including children, women and the elderly. These people are not fighting the fighters, but rather are killing and committing massacres against civilians and innocents. The Islamic resistance will continue to confront the Israeli enemy in support of Gaza and Palestine in defense of Lebanon.
Over the past 24 hours, Israeli strikes in Lebanon have killed at least 105 people, bringing the death toll over the past 2 weeks to over 1,000, with 6,000 people injured. The Israeli attacks have displaced about 1 million people in Lebanon. More than 100,000 have fled from Lebanon to Syria, according to the United Nations. Meanwhile, Israel forces launched a wave of airstrikes on Yemen Sunday, targeting the city of Hodeidah for the second time in recent months in response to missile fires by Houthi militants. This comes as more than 1,000 Israelis protested in Tel Aviv on Saturday to call on Prime Minister Netanyahu to refocus his efforts on securing the release of hostages in Gaza, where the death toll from nearly a year of Israeli attacks is nearing at least 42,000. For more, we begin in Beirut to speak with Karim Chahayeb, the Beirut-based journalist reporting on Lebanon, Syria and Iraq for the Associated Press. His recent piece for AP is headlined, What to Know After Israel's Assassination of Hezbollah Leader Hassan Nasrallah. Karim, welcome to Democracy Now! Well, why don't you tell us about the significance of this assassination and who exactly the Hezbollah leader was?
So, this assassination really rattled all of Lebanon. Hassan Nasrallah for decades led Hezbollah and oversaw significant developments within the militant group, oversaw, ending Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, Hezbollah's sort of transformation into having a more heavy involvement in Lebanese politics with MPs, parliamentarians, ministers, and so on, and also led Hezbollah when it began to expand more regionally, notably in Syria, where they played a pivotal role in keeping Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in power. The news really shocked all of Lebanon, both supporters and people who oppose him. I recall I was on the streets here in Beirut when the news happened, and some of his supporters were screaming. They were way shocked by the news, and they thought that this was a leader. Some told me that they felt like he was immortal, almost. And of course, his assassination, on top of a handful of Hezbollah leaders, seven senior leaders over the past 8 days, really rattled the organization. Even the deputy leader Naim Qasem said so today. But he said that they're going to regroup and appoint a new leader soon. It's unclear when, and it's definitely something that rattled the region, for sure.
I want to go to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu speaking this weekend.
Nasrallah was not just another terrorist. He was the terrorist. He was the axis of the axis, the main engine of Iran's axis of evil. He and his people were the architects of the plan to destroy Israel. As long as Nasrallah was alive, he would have quickly rebuilt the capabilities we took from Hezbollah. Therefore, I gave the directive, and Nasrallah is no longer with us.
If you can respond, Karim, to what the Israeli prime minister said after the assassination, and also what has happened since, both the killing of a top-level Iranian commander, along with Nasrallah, and now the head of Hamas in Lebanon with his family.
So, a lot of people after the assassination of Nasrallah sort of wondered, what happens next now. The Israeli government maintains that their goal is to, secure their north for their residents to return. And, since the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, other senior officials have been assassinated as well. And the airstrikes, aren't stopping. They're continuing. And now people are anticipating a ground invasion. And, of course, experts say that Iran is sort of in a policy dilemma. Iran has dealt with several attacks that are widely blamed on Israel, including a strike on a consulate building in Syria and the killing of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran in late July. Iran hasn't necessarily responded in such a decisive way. And the question is, what are Tehran's red lines? We don't know how they're going to respond to that and what this means for the region. What we do know is that they've sort of maintained that they're going to keep piling diplomatic pressure. This is according to statements from different Iranian government officials. But the big question is, given the severity of this attack, will this eventually not just widen the war in Lebanon, but also have a regional component? Iran has, proxies in Yemen and Iraq, and there's a lot of speculation as to whether they will be involved or not. So there's a really big sort of gap as to what happens next in this very intense phase of the war.
Karim, we're speaking to you in Beirut, so you're not only a journalist covering all of this, you're a resident there. Can you describe what the blast was like in the suburb on Friday, and then this Beirut-based blast that just took place?
Yeah, the airstrike in the Beirut southern suburbs that killed Hassan Nasrallah was probably one of the most, if not the most, intense strike thus far in this conflict. Eyewitnesses and others, even as actually close to this office, heard 8 to 10 explosions. There were multiple airstrikes, and it leveled several buildings to the ground. It was a very shocking experience for many here. A lot of people were, panicking, and it definitely sparked a wave of displacement. A lot of people in the Beirut southern suburbs, immediately fled their homes and, went in large groups to other neighborhoods in Beirut to find safety. And then the strike yesterday near the Kola Bridge, you know, it's a very central part of the city. It's very busy during the day. It's a critical point for public transportation as well. And this is the most central part of Beirut where Israel has struck so far in this conflict. And, you know, a lot of the questions now among people here is, you know, where else will be hit, given that it appears that, you know, central parts of the city are could be possible targets. And this is not limited to just the south or the east of Lebanon anymore. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety and confusion among residents all over Beirut, where over the past, you know, previous months, where the fighting was mostly limited to southern Lebanon, you didn't really feel that so much.
And we just have reports, I mean, and this has been going on for days, of Israeli tanks amassing along the border. What is the response of the Lebanese to what is taking place? I mean, Lebanon has one of the most, if not the highest percentage refugee population in the world. Now, 1 million people are displaced. Many are trying to go into Syria right now.
Yes, so, you know, the Lebanese government has sounded the alarm on a massive displacement. Prior to this recent intense escalation, I guess, there was, you know, over 100,000 displaced people. Now that number is almost 1 million in such a short period of time. The Lebanese government is struggling to keep up. Remember, this is a country that's going through an economic crisis. The government is essentially broke, and the United Nations is trying to get as much funds as it can to support. And a lot of what's helping these displaced people here is just the goodwill of a lot of people, community initiatives and so on. A lot of people I speak to in Beirut and elsewhere are doing their best, but they're questioning how sustainable it is, you know, within just a couple of weeks. And yes, it does seem like a larger number are going to Syria as well. So it's indicative of the desperation taking place. And of course, you know, a possible ground invasion is certainly the talk of the town right now. And people are wondering what the consequences will be, whether it means this war will last for a much longer time and it will further widen the displacement. So, it is definitely a critical time. The Lebanese government, is trying to sort of push a recent, you know, U.S.-led initiative for a temporary ceasefire for 21 days. The French foreign ministers in town met with the prime minister and the speaker of parliament. And, you know, it appears that the message that they're sending is that they're willing to, you know, go about the ceasefire and, you know, and try and put an end to this war as quickly as possible. The question is whether, you know, Hezbollah at the same time, you know, whether they will change their approach to this. You know, Hezbollah maintained even after Nasrallah's assassination that they will stop once there's a ceasefire in Gaza. And they accused the Israelis and the American government of basically wanting them to set up a deal independent of Gaza. So the question really is, how can this diplomatic gridlock be broken? And I think we could be at a major turning point right now, given the heightened developments.
Do you see Lebanese troops joining or replacing Hezbollah militants on the border?
There is certainly a lot of speculation that has come about, you know, the fate of Lebanon politically and with the war after Nasrallah's assassination. There are allied groups to Hezbollah that have been involved in the south since the beginning. For example, the Fajr brigades of the Islamic group, which is the branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas early on as well here in Lebanon were involved as well. The question, of course, is if there's a ground invasion, will more groups allied that have, you know, some sort of weapons be involved? Appears that most experts say that it might actually be more about the allies of Hezbollah outside of Lebanon, whether the Houthis in Yemen or the Iran-backed militias in Iraq will be much more involved. So that is sort of the big question right now, given a possible ground invasion.
Kadeem Chahiab, we want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Beirut, journalist covering Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq for the Associated Press. We'll link to your piece, What to Know After Israel's Assassination of Hezbollah Leader Hassan Nasrallah. When we come back, we'll be joined by Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv, the award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, a member of its editorial board. One of his latest pieces the Haaretz newspaper, Israel's barbaric lee over Nasrallah's assassination, is a new low for Israeli society. Back in 20 seconds. Palestinian song, Hawk of Lebanon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as Israel strikes central Beirut, Yemen, and Gaza after the massive attack Friday in the Beirut suburb that killed the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, one of the most powerful figures in the region. We're joined by Gideon Levy. He is Israeli journalist, author, columnist for Haaretz, as well as a member of its editorial board. His latest piece, Israel's barbaric glee over Nasrallah's assassination, is a new low for Israeli society. Gideon, thanks so much for joining us again. If you can start off by talking about what happened on Friday. You have Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, ascending the podium at the UN General Assembly, apparently right after he gave the go-ahead for the assassination of Nasrallah, right before he came up on the podium. Dozens of world leaders walked out. If you can talk about the significance of this decision and then the bombing of Yemen and, of course, the continuation of the assault on Gaza.
You know, Amy, listening to your program is enough. Israel is shooting here, and Israel is assassinating there, and Israel is bombing here, and Israel is bombing there. Where are we aiming to? I mean, all those operations might be, at least part of them, are justified. But what comes next? This thought that Israel can solve everything by force, and the war is always the first answer for everything, must change, because otherwise we will really find ourselves one day totally lonely in the world. Even the United States, which supports Israel still blindly and automatically, and I must emphasize in your show that the United States is a full partner for everything that Israel is doing in the last year, including the massacre in Gaza. Even the United States will wake up one day. And then what?
So talk about the assassination of Nasrallah. You're talking to us from Tel Aviv and the response in Israel.
I'll give you a few examples. In the one of the main channels of Israeli TV, a reporter, live, was distributing chocolates. That's the spirit in Israel. That's the spirit. Another important columnist wrote, "We smashed him like a lizard." I mean, if this is the atmosphere, this is the mindset, this is the zeitgeist even, so it will be very hard to change things, because we are getting down and down, lower and lower, believing more and more only in one thing, namely in killing and destructing.
So... if you can talk about what Netanyahu's strategy is, and if he has one other than a military strategy. You have the tanks, Israeli tanks, amassing on the border. Do you see a ground invasion of Lebanon happening at this point? What does this mean? Does he just want to deplete Hezbollah or completely wipe it out?
I can't see a scenario in which Israel is not going for a ground operation. First, it will be, as usual, presented as a very, very limited one, limited in time, limited in territory. We have been in those shows many times. And then it will get complicated, and then we'll have to widen it and expand the time that we stay there. As usual, we are getting into those things without having any clue, any idea how will we get out of it. Look at Israel in Gaza. Nobody has a clue how we are getting out of Gaza. We're not getting out of Gaza. Israel is going to repeat the same mistake with Lebanon, using the excuse or the passiveness of the world, which allows Israel to do now whatever it wants. Netanyahu, I think, is also now in euphoria after what is perceived in Israel as wonderful successes, James Bond successes, first with the pagers and with the walkie-talkies, and then with all the assassinations. This is perceived in Israel as an enormous success. So riding on this success, I guess nothing will stop Israel to get into a ground operation. And then, you know, there will be a moment that a regional war might become a factor, might become a reality. And then what, when Iran might come in? I mean, all those risks seem what? Unimportant, unreal. And if Iran comes into the picture, what's next? We will bomb Iran. This whole mindset of bombing and bombing for 1 year now, and only bombing and refusing any kind of diplomacy. Remember, there were deals to release the hostages. Israel said no. Ceasefire, Israel said no. Lebanon ceasefire, Israel says no. This will not guarantee the security of Israel, not to speak about the price the other side is paying, but even the security of Israel will not get better. We are now in a less good situation than 1 year ago. I can tell you that in Tel Aviv, we are more scared than we were 1 year ago.
The U.S. military said Sunday it's increasing its air support capabilities in the Middle East, putting troops on heightened alert. ABC News' Martha Raddatz interviewed White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby on this week Sunday and asked about the reports.
There's a contingency of additional forces in the region right now to help us with any possible contingencies that might come up.
Dozens more? I mean, I know we have 40,000 troops in the region.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the exact numbers or who these guys are, but we did deploy some additional forces into the region. I would tell you that there's other options available as well in terms of adding and enhancing that force posture.
So you talk, Gideon Levy, about a regional war. Right before Netanyahu spoke at the UN, as you said, there was this discussion that the U.S. and France was leading with Saudi Arabia and others and to have a ceasefire. And then Hassan Nasrallah is assassinated. Is this more than Israel engaging in a regional war, but trying to bring the U.S. into it as well? Netanyahu is known as a close Trump ally and friend, how that would affect the U.S. elections as well. And right before Netanyahu spoke at the United Nations, you have Israel saying Thursday it had secured another $8.7 billion in aid from the United States to support its ongoing military efforts. We're going to end with this question of whether Israel could continue what it does if the U.S. stopped the weapons flow.
But the U.S. does not stop the weapons. That's the point. The U.S. is saying one thing and acting exactly to the opposite direction. Can you believe that a major superpower is telling Israel to stop the war, and in the same time it is supplying it with weapons and bombs and ammunition? What is Israel supposed to do? Why not to shoot and to bomb, to continue to do this, if the Americans are supplying it in an unconditioned way? No conditions. So this hypocrisy must come to its end. The United States is supporting the war, is supporting Israel. The bombs that were falling on the bunker of Nasrallah were American bombs. The bombs that fall on Gaza are American bombs. The children who were killed, 17,000 of them in Gaza, were killed by American ammunition. And America, United States, cannot say that it is against killing children because it is a partner.
Gideon Levy, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, also on their editorial board. We'll link to your latest pieces, including Israel's barbaric glee over Nasrallah's assassination is a new low for Israeli society. This is Democracy Now! We're going to turn to Washington, D.C. right now for more on all of this, to look at how Iran could respond to the Israeli strike Friday in Lebanon that killed the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. We go to Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's just written a piece for Zateo, headlined, "Nasrallah Assassinated, What Happens Next?" Trita, thanks for joining us again. What happens next? And can you respond to the assassination of the longtime Hezbollah leader since, what, 1992, Hassan Nasrallah?
So a lot of eyes are, of course, on Iran and trying to figure out what Iran is going to do next. But we have to recognize that Israel has quite successfully cornered Iran. Iran played the long game, tried to avoid a direct confrontation with Israel, absorbed a lot of hits. But in the process of playing the long game, its options have become fewer, weaker, and more dangerous. At this point, if Iran does almost anything, it will risk triggering the larger regional war that Netanyahu wants and that the Iranians have tried to avoid. As a result, I think our eyes should actually be on what Israel does next, whether it will go through with an invasion. We're already seeing reports now that some commando raids have been conducted inside of Lebanon by the Israelis, probably in preparation for a land invasion, as well as what Israel plans to do with the Houthis. If it reaches a point in which the Iranians conclude that Israel's strategy is to take out some of these entities before going to Iran itself, that may trigger the Iranians to act now in the hope of actually having better options now rather than waiting. But other than that, the Iranians seem to be of the mindset that they do not want to get in a direct engagement because of their own internal problems. Iran is faced with a significant anger from the population over the abuse and repression of the Iranian regime, particularly in the protest of 2 years ago. It does not believe that he actually can afford a war of this kind. Instead, its priorities are to try to see if he can get a deal with the United States on the nuclear issue, reduce tensions, lift some of the sanctions, improve the economy in order to reduce the distance between the society and the government. The last thing they want in that context is a war with Israel that will most likely increase that distance and the anger of the population.
In addition to the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah on Friday, Israel killed the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the deputy commander Abbas Nilfurushan, who was killed in that Nasrallah strike, a seminal or key figure in the Iran-Iraq war. Can you talk about his significance? And then the role of the new Iranian president, seen as a reformist?
So Iran has taken quite a lot of hits. Nilfurushan is just the latest commander that has been killed by the Israelis, not just since October 7th, but over the course of several years in Syria and in Lebanon itself. And this is part of their long game in terms of not necessarily reacting to each and every one of these, because they know that Israel is in a stronger position and Israel has an interest of having a confrontation sooner rather than later. But again, that strategy, that long-term strategy only works if there's also a short game. And Iran's short game seems to be losing right now, given how Israel has managed to crack the communication system of Hezbollah, take out the top echelon of its commanders, and put Hezbollah in a very, very weak position.
So the U.S. struck Hodeidah in Yemen, and the Houthis. Now the question is how they will respond. Can you talk about Iran's relationship with the Houthis, with Hamas, and with Hezbollah?
I think one of the things that has not been acknowledged, at least not in the Western narrative about October 7th, is that it clearly came at a very bad time for the Iranians and for Hezbollah itself. I think actually there's been privately quite a lot of irritation in Tehran with Hamas because it obviously did not coordinate any of that with Iranians. The Iranians, Hezbollah, were not even aware of the plans that Hamas had for that attack. And the reason, again, is because it forced a confrontation with Israel at a much earlier stage than what the Iranians and Hezbollah were ready for. Lebanon's economy was in complete disaster. Iran had its own problems. They were not looking for a fight. Hamas's calculation was completely different. And it also shows you the distance that does exist between these different entities. Iran and Hezbollah are much, much closer to each other, whereas Hamas is a more recent addition to Iran's axis and a very problematic one in terms of their relationship. They've had several fallouts. Hamas originally was quite a strong enemy of Iran. Then you have the Houthis, who is a very different entity, does its own thing, is part of the axis essentially, but has made it very clear it is not taking any orders from Iran. It's been quite critical publicly of Iran, arguing that Iran has been far too risk averse and that Iran should have entered into this fight much, much sooner rather than watching from afar and not aiding Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis to the extent that they believe that Iran should have.
I want to finally ask about the same question I put to Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv, Trita. You're Iranian-American. You've been writing extensively books on U.S.-Iranian-Israel policy. Among your books, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Your first book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. Do you feel that the Israeli prime minister is attempting to pull Iran into a war with the United States as the number one sponsor, the United States, of the military in Israel?
I don't think there is any doubt that that is Netanyahu's game plan. And the reason why he has been successful in the last couple of weeks is not because of any particular action by the Israelis, although, of course, they've scored some major successes. It's because of the posture of the Biden administration. Biden has chosen to be so deferential, more deferential than any other American president has been, to Netanyahu. And as a result, despite all of the talk of wanting to avoid a larger regional war, which clearly is in the U.S. interest to avoid, Biden has adopted a posture in which he essentially says that that's what he wants to avoid, but then he provides the Israelis with the weapons, the political protection, the diplomatic support, and the arms and money to be able to pursue exactly the escalation that Biden says that he does not want. That's the big difference that has happened here now, that the United States has now, under Biden, chosen to completely be in support of whatever Netanyahu wants to do. And Netanyahu's plan for quite some time has been to reverse the balance in the Middle East, to make sure that Israel is once again enjoying a much stronger and favorable position in the region by cutting down many of the different challengers to Israel that exist in the region. Reversing that balance is not something that Israel can do on its own. It can only do so by bringing in the United States into the war, whether it is directly or in the manner that Biden has been supporting everything that Israel is doing.
I mean, you have U.S. troops, you have the warships in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf, you have U.S. soldiers in Jordan, around 50,000 overall U.S. soldiers in the area. If this is intensified, how do you see this playing out in the U.S. election? Do you actually think, I mean, after Netanyahu addressed the U.S. Congress and got more applause than any president in U.S. history, I asked, what, more than 50 standing ovations, he went down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump. This will serve Trump in this election.
Whether one thinks that Trump is going to be different or not from what Biden has done or what Harris may do, reality is, I think, that if you have this explosion taking place in the region, with the U.S. itself getting dragged into the war before the elections, it will serve Trump. The Biden administration have gone out and said that they've been working 24 hours without any rest to try to secure a ceasefire for more than 10 months now, and they have absolutely nothing to show for it except for constantly giving Israel more weapons and arms. And if that may not push away some of the more loyal supporters of the centrist elements of the Democratic Party, I think it does significantly risk losing a lot of the people who have been on the fence, who have given Biden the benefit of the doubt. Certainly were willing to give Kamala Harris the benefit of the doubt. But if this disaster happens, I think those that voting bloc, which I'm not talking about the Arab Americans or the Gen Z or the Muslim Americans, but that other voting bloc that is more on the fence on this, they may also be lost as a result of this.
Trita Parsi, want to thank you for being with us. Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece in Zatteo, Nasrallah Assassinated, What Happens Next. Author of a number of books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Next up, Hurricane Helene tears through the southeastern United States as scientists say climate change rapidly intensifies hurricanes. We'll speak with climate activist and scientist Peter Kalmus in North Carolina, one of the states hit hardest by the storm. Stay with us. And the rich keep getting richer, and the wrong and the right. Become the victims of the armies of the night. The odds are never even, and their skins are never white. Third World War by Kris Kristofferson. The politically conscious singer and actor died Saturday at the age of 88. He once said, quote, I was in Nicaragua with Sandinistas. I've argued for Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the United Farm Workers. I've been a radical for a long time. I guess it's too bad. I'd be more marketable as a right-wing redneck. But I got this. I got into this to tell the truth, Kris Kristofferson said. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at Hurricane Helene as the Category 4 storm tore through the southeastern United States, leaving nearly 100 people dead in a trail of devastation. The storm triggered catastrophic flooding, tornado damage, downed trees, submerged entire neighborhoods in water across Florida, Georgia, Virginia, Tennessee, and North and South Carolina. At least 30 deaths were reported in a single county in North Carolina, Buncombe County, where the city of Asheville has been cut off after the Swannanoa River crested 6 feet above previous records, flooding entire neighborhoods. Officials say the death toll is likely to rise as many more are still missing. Hundreds of roads remain blocked by mudslides and standing water, hindering rescue efforts and the delivery of vital aid and supplies. Meanwhile, more than 2 million customers remain without power as of Monday, while there's limited phone and communications access. In North Carolina, city officials say Asheville residents may not have access to clean water for weeks after Helene severely damaged its water treatment plant and piping system. Many state residents criticized officials for failing to share accurate information about the severity of the storm ahead of it making landfall. Hurricane Helene made landfall Friday in Florida's Big Bend, fueled by abnormally warm water in the Gulf of Mexico. On Saturday, Greenpeace posted on social media that, quote, Hurricane Helene must be a wake-up call for climate justice. For more, we go to Raleigh, North Carolina, where we're joined by Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. He's speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. Peter, can you talk about the link between what has taken place in the southeastern United States and the climate catastrophe, climate change?
Yeah, so the planet's overheating. It's irreversible. It's caused by the fossil fuel industry. And the reason I say industry specifically and not fossil fuels is because this industry has been systematically lying and blocking action for almost 50 years, for decades and decades. And they've said publicly, testifying in front of Congress, that they plan to continue systematically blocking action. And this will get worse as the planet continues to get hotter. It's getting hotter every day. Every day we continue burning fossil fuels and allowing this industry to continue spreading disinformation. and blocking action, the planet gets hotter. Hotter ocean fuels these storms, causes them to intensify more rapidly, causes them to get much more powerful, and a hotter atmosphere, because we're living on an currently overheating planet, hotter atmosphere holds more water. So we get these intense rainfalls, which cause the sorts of flooding that's happening right now. It's still high waters in the western part of my state. I think that this is the most evil thing that it's possible to imagine, that fossil fuel executives and lobbyists will continue to lie so that they can line their bank accounts more at the irreversible expense of our planet and the future of humanity.
I saw you at Climate Week this past week here in New York City. Among the actions that took place was people attempting to shut down Citibank for funding, continuing to fund fossil fuel projects. The day that I was covering it, 31 people were arrested. Can you talk about the significance of these actions? I mean, you're a scientist. You, too, have been arrested protesting issues around climate change and entities that are involved in fueling climate change. What effect does activism have on the scientists? You're both.
Well, yeah, I feel desperate as a climate scientist. I've been sounding the alarm since 2006. Other scientists have been sounding it for far longer. Dr. James Hansen in the 80s, even back before that. And we've been completely ignored. You get politicians, even like President Biden, even Democrats, saying things that, like, we listen to the scientists. And then, you know, the last presidential debate, we had Trump saying this is a hoax and giving word salad with China. And then Vice President Harris saying climate change is real, but we're going to expand fracking, right? And that's the cause of climate change. So we're living in this strange dystopia where scientists are being completely ignored. So I personally don't know what else to do. I've tried a lot of different kinds of activism. Civil disobedience has by far been the most effective in building the movement, inspiring other activists, getting this urgency. So we need the public to have two things before, I think, before we're going to be able to act, before we're going to hold these politicians to account. We need urgency and we need cause. And the public, in my opinion, doesn't know those two things. Like, they don't have the sense that this is existentially urgent, that this is irreversible. However hot the planet gets, that's how hot it's going to stay for the rest of our lives, for our children's lives, grandchildren, many, many generations, and they don't know cause. There's a lot of confusion. This is caused by the fossil fuel industry. So if we want to stop this, preserve what we can, we need to know that that's the cause, that they're blocking action, and we have to target that. Financing from the banks is a huge part of this. They're still expanding new fossil fuel projects like the Mountain Valley Pipeline in my state and in Virginia, which is creating natural gas for export that we don't even need in America, just so these fat cats like Joe Manchin can get more rich. People don't understand this, and they need to know urgency. This is irreversible. These storms, heat waves, floods, crop failures, migrants, all of this destabilization is going to get worse. It seems like we're, you know, just as humans, more interested in blowing each other up than being grateful and preserving this absolute jewel of a planet that has gives us all of this life, gives us literally everything. And it seems like we're not able to get our act together. And, you know, we have everything we need to stop this problem. We have solar panels, we have battery storage, we have wind. If there was will, if the media let people know, if the presidents and world leaders let people know urgency and cause, I think we would solve this so incredibly fast. But there's just confusion out there. The Republican Party is still deeply in denial. The Democratic Party is still deeply in denial. And it's just a human tragedy unfolding in real time. And I'm just so disappointed at everyone right now. Not everyone, but most people.
Dr. Khan, let's talk specifically about the media. It's the way people come to understand the world outside of their own conversations and their reading. Can you talk about how the media addresses climate change?
Yeah, so I was reading some articles about the flooding in Western North Carolina in the New York Times. The articles did not even mention climate change, not a single mention. This is what's driving it. And then there's the larger context of irreversible global overheating, which I've already mentioned. It's caused by the fossil fuel industry. They've been lying and blocking action systematically for decades, and this impact will get worse. We'll see even worse storms in the future. It's all like the gradation of climate impacts, everything we've been seeing around the world happening more frequently, more intensely, until, you know, global systems of infrastructure, food, water start to break down in ways that are hard to imagine for us right now. This all gets worse as things get hotter and hotter, driven by the fossil fuel industry, which has been lying. I think that's critical. Obviously, probably shouldn't say it in such an emotional way as what I've just said, because they're trying to be objective reporters. I'm speaking as a human right now, as a parent. But they need to, reporters need to start giving this whole context. This is part of the whole story.
We have 5 seconds, Peter.
Yeah. Anyway, do better, media, please.
Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. Happy birthday to Paul.
In Houston, I'm Elise Bench with KPFT News. Thanks for joining us on this Monday, September 30th. These are some of the stories we're following today in and around our city and state. As of tomorrow, we are exactly 5 weeks away from the November election, and time is running out for you to register to vote in Texas. The deadline to be registered is Monday, October 7th. There is no online voter registration available in Texas, so you must return your paper application to your county voter registrar's office, which you can do in person or by mail. Voter registration applications are available at public libraries as well as all government offices. You can also go to votetexas.gov to print an application and check your voter status.